Tom Hartman Program.
Tom Hartman.
For your minimum daily adult requirement of sanity.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. It's Friday. Anything Goes Friday. Actually, in the third hour of our program, Larissa Alexandrovna is going to drop by and tell us about a political prisoner in the United States, the consequence of one of these federal prosecutors that Karl Rove maneuvered into prosecuting a Democrat purely for political purposes, and this guy ended up in jail. And when a number of Republicans were involved, they were not prosecuted. It's just a very, very incredibly mind-bogglingly sleazy story, and she's done some incredible investigative journalism on it. That'll be in our third hour. But for the rest of the day, Anything Goes Friday, and of course our first hour is always on Friday, has been for going on 5 years now, Senator Bernie Sanders. Senator Sanders, the independent from Vermont, his website, sanders.senate.gov. I think of him as America's senator, although he does a marvelous job representing the state of Vermont as well. Bernie Sanders, welcome to the program.
Good to be with you, Tom.
Great to have you, Bernie. There are two pieces of legislation that I think in many people's minds were the same thing. There's global warming legislation and also this energy bill, which addresses global warming.
I know they sound alike, but they are, in fact, different pieces. And both of them, the energy bill passed the House. Once again, we couldn't get it past the Senate. We had 53 votes to pass a reasonably strong energy bill. But for the 57th time, the obstructionist Republican Party has filibustered this bill. We could not get cloture, and so we have not yet passed that. And, of course, the president is sitting there, I think, threatening to veto this bill. Now, it is incomprehensible to me that we have people in the United States Senate who do not want to raise what we call CAFE standards, the mileage per gallon that cars used in the United States get. They do not want to make our country more energy efficient. They do not want to move us to sustainable energy. I really cannot understand that. But this Republican obstructionism continues. And now, I guess today, for the 57th time, they have filibustered legislation. We'll see what happens next week.
You know, I think Bernie, most Americans have no idea.
Right. Let me say a word on that. I think you're absolutely right, Tom. And you know, one of the frustrations I think that some of us here in D.C. have is the media does just an abysmal job in reporting, A, how the system works and what goes on here, what doesn't go on here. What probably the majority of the people think is, gee, if you have 51 votes, you pass legislation. That sounds pretty simple and straightforward, and that sounds like majority should rule. That is not what happens. What happens is that in order to end debate in the Senate, you need 60 votes. That's called cloture. And it is virtually impossible on many important pieces of legislation to get those 60 votes. So just on the energy bill a few hours ago, the Republicans were against it. I think we ended up with 53 votes. We got a few Republicans, vast majority against it. So we still do not have passage of an energy bill. The Republican Party has broken, as I understand it, the all-time world record for 1 year in terms of filibusters. I think today was the 57th time. So when people sit home, they say, well, why isn't this Congress moving forward? The House could pass a million things. But unless we get 60 votes to end debate, and then, of course, we have to worry about a presidential veto and getting two-thirds to override that veto, you can't pass legislation. And that is happening time and time and time again. You know, and I know, Tom, you have made this point, and I think you do a great job on it. What is going on here, essentially, overview, in terms of the process, is what Bush and his friends are about, huge tax breaks for the wealthiest 1%. They're not content right now that in America we have the by far the most unequal distribution of wealth and income, richest 1% earning far more than the bottom 50%. That is not good enough for them. And they stay up nights worrying about their billionaire friends. So tax breaks for billionaires. They are prepared to spend over $10 billion every single month fighting the war in Iraq. And President Bush says, oh, my goodness, he has to veto almost every appropriations bill because in total, it spends $22 billion more than he wants. And what he wants to do is you name the issue. Whether it is education, whether it is Head Start, whether it is child care, whether it is heating assistance for low-income people, whether it is financial aid for college students in terms of the Perkins program. You name the program that benefits lower income or working people, we don't have enough money for it. You name the tax breaks for billionaires, we're there. We have all the money you need. You name military spending, you name a weapon system, you name the war in Iraq, we're going to be there forever. That's okay. We have enough money for that. And then
on our credit card.
On our credit card, absolutely. And then you move toward, and I know you have been strong on this issue, understanding the privatization of government, so the government is unable, literally unable, to provide the services that it needs to the people, and more and more of what we do is controlled by, you know, the Lockheed Martins of the world, the Halliburtons of the world, and that is the direction these guys are going. And the point is, they are very, very, very radical in terms of undoing all of the benefits that working people have fought for so many years, and want to move this country into almost an oligarchic form of government. Now, having said all of that, we will see what happens, but the committee that I'm on, chaired by Senator Barbara Boxer, the Environment and Public Works Committee, earlier this week passed legislation on global warming, which is a different bill than on the energy bill, which is far and away the strongest bill ever passed on global warming by a major committee here. Does it go as far as I would want? No. But one of the things that I fought for, which is in that legislation, is it begins to provide, if passed, over a period of many years, substantial funding for sustainable energy. I happen to believe that within a fairly short period of time, you're going to see technologies like solar energy and wind energy become cost competitive with conventional fuels, and what you are going to see is huge amounts of energy being produced by sustainable energy at reasonable prices, which not only does not cause carbon emissions, but also is cleaner in terms of other pollutants as well. So if we are smart about it, we can transform our energy system away from fossil fuel big time into energy efficiency. Now, one of the things that the energy bill does that our Republican friends have obstructed today is increase what we call CAFE standards. That's the mileage per gallon that cars get, to 35 miles per gallon.
It's a corporate average fuel efficiency.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Now, is that enough? No, it's not. In Europe, they're talking, they have now, I think, 44 miles per gallon. And this would not take place, it would take place gradually over a period of years. But it is a step forward, and we have to fight the automobile industry big time to do that. So the potential, I think, for transforming our energy system, if we're smart, creating a whole lot of jobs, reversing global warming, cleaning up the environment, is huge. And let's hope that we can overcome the Republican obstructionism and this reactionary president that we have.
But Bernie, and Bernie, it's, you know, Harry Truman ran against the do-nothing Congress and won. George Bush came out 2 days ago, 3 days ago in his news conference where he famously lied to us about when he knew about this NIE. And the entire news conference, up until the point they started asking questions, was bashing you guys in Congress for not doing anything.
Well, here's what it is, obviously.
Why doesn't Harry Reid start saying, okay, you guys, you want a filibuster? You can have a filibuster, but the American people are going to realize it because you're going to be talking all night.
The answer is yes, I agree with you. The answer is sometimes it's difficult getting that out through the media. But it is very clear. The Republicans lost the elections last year because they were the most ineffective and wasteful Congress, you know, that we have seen for many, many years, and people threw them out. And what they understood on day one is they said, look, we accomplished nothing. The people turned on us. What do we have to do now? We're in the minority. We have got to prevent the new congressional leadership from accomplishing almost anything. And we have got to obstruct, we've got to filibuster, and that is what they have to do, what they have done. Now, having said that, we have passed some good pieces, important legislation. I've talked about them on previous programs. The Higher Education Reconciliation Act is going to substantially increase Pell Grants for college families, lower interest rates, and provide debt forgiveness for millions of families that are trying to send their kids to college. It's a big deal. We have finally done well by our veterans. That has still not passed. That will pass. The largest increase in VA funding in the history of the VA, beginning to take care of both our older veterans and the folks coming home from Iraq and Afghanistan.
So what Harry Reid is doing is he's saying, we're going to do good stuff rather than lose the good stuff in exchange for the political theater of showing the Republicans for what
he
they
is trying hard to do, understanding the crises facing this country, to pass serious legislation.
Yeah, that's a tough one because it's like what's more important, the public good or the politics, which may lead to the public good.
Right. Okay.
Yeah, that's a tough one. Anyhow, we can talk about it more as we come back. We'll be taking your calls, 866-303-2270 for Senator Bernie Sanders, sanders.senate.gov, 16 minutes past the hour. Minutes past the hour. It's Anything Goes Friday, our first hour brunch with Bernie. Senator Bernie Sanders on the line with us, taking your calls. And Bernie, were you in mid-thought when we took that last break, or you want to just...
No, we're ready to go, Tom.
Okay. All righty, great. 866-303-2270, our telephone number. And Karen in Portland, Oregon, listening on KPOJ. Hey, Karen, you're live with Senator Sanders.
Hi, Senator Sanders. I wanted to ask a question, and I wondered if I could preface it with a few comments first.
Sure.
It has to do with what do we need to get people to come to the polls to vote. And Tom this week had suggested that we need to fine people for not voting. And that really goes against my grain. And I was thinking that we need to educate people. We need a good educational system. We need a free media. We need to have a restored and healthy middle class. And those, to me, are the preconditions for really getting people to the polls. I think we need a national holiday for voting so that people who are working two jobs or single moms, you know, can get to the polls. What do you think?
You know what I think, Aaron? I think exactly what you think. I think you are very articulate in making all of the right points. We need to educate the American people who are overworked, who are exhausted, who have become cynical about the political process. And as I mentioned earlier, here's what Bush and his friends are doing. Some of us are trying hard to pass serious legislation that would reaffirm the faith of the American people in the ability of government to do something for the middle class and working people. They're vetoing this legislation. They're filibustering this legislation. And then they say, and Bush gets on television and he says, see, nothing is happening. It doesn't matter who is running the government. And the media will not make it clear that that is because he is vetoing and they are filibustering. I agree with you also, by the way, that I think we need a national holiday on Election Day. You know, we have people who are working so hard, they have to get up in some cases 6-7 o'clock in the morning, and yes, they can vote absentee, et cetera, et cetera. But I think we should make it as positive and as interesting and as easy for people to vote as possible. Needless to say, our Republican friends want to do exactly the opposite. They want to discourage people from voting. In some cases, they want to intimidate people from voting because they understand that if working people don't vote, if lower-income people don't vote, if you just have upper-income people and the upper-middle-class voting, people voting, they stand a better chance to win. So you are absolutely right. Expanding, doing everything that we can to make it, to expand the number of people who vote is a top priority.
John in Los Angeles, you're on the air with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Good morning, Senator. The question I got is I'd like to know what's going on with the credit card companies. The reason I ask is I have a business and I have one credit card that my wife and I pay off monthly. And you cannot reserve a plane ticket, a hotel room, or anything without a credit card anymore.
Right.
And we recently got our statement, and I was out of the country, and I had a $3,000 charge. We paid it off. And the next month, within 2 weeks, I get another statement saying, okay, you got a $14.95 processing fee and a $65 finance charge. And if I wouldn't have called in and said, look, I'm going to send this to the Senate. I'll pay it. I'll send it to the Senate and have you guys investigate because this is ridiculous. They said, let me give you to the department that handles that. And they waived the fee and apologized.
Because you were persistent.
Right. It's crazy.
Okay, it's not... Thank you very much, Don, for that question. I would not say it is quote-unquote crazy. What they are doing is ripping off the American people. It's not crazy from their perspective because they are making more and more money and more profits based on fees. You have an absurd situation. I was on the House, when I was in the House, I was on the Financial Services Committee and was very active in this issue. You have not only excessive fees, you get fees for no particular reason at all. And we have heard of other instances where people said, hey, they called up the credit card company and said, you're ripping me off. And they said, oh, okay. In so many words, you caught us. Okay, we'll rescind that fee.
Oops. Yeah.
Oops, right, you got us. You have a situation where people are being paying 25-28% interest rates. You have this. Here's an unbelievable number. Every family listening to this program has probably received these letters from the credit card companies with zero interest prominently emblazoned on the envelope. Low interest fees and these credit card prospectives there. They have sent out, Tom, do you know how many they send out in a year?
Enough that my cat gets one.
Enough. They send out, last I heard, the number may have gone up is $4
billion. Whoa.
And the reason that they can send out that number, which is not, it's an expensive proposition, is they can lure enough people into this business at zero interest, 2%. And meanwhile, people don't read the small print where interest rates can soar for virtually any reason whatsoever. So it is a scandal. We dealt with it in the House. I think you're beginning to see more and more discussion about it here in the Senate. And basically, it's usury, and we got to deal with that issue.
Yeah. The whole, and it's not just the credit card companies. The banks are getting in on it, too. It's just, you know, it's just amazing. The wonders of deregulation.
Right.
Senator Bernie Sanders on the line with us. It's our Brunch with Bernie segment, sanders.senate.gov, his website, rstomhartman.com. If you want to drop into our live chat room, I'll go hang out there for the next few minutes here during the break. And also our blog over at airamerica.com, 27 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
And welcome back. 34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. By the way, just a quick heads up. Next Friday, I'll be in Minneapolis, Minnesota, 7 p.m., the University of Minnesota bookstore at Coffin Memorial Union, giving a riff on Cracking the Code, my new book, and also signing books. On January 7th and 8th, we'll be in Manchester, New Hampshire. We'll be doing our show live from the New Hampshire primaries. Radio Row there, put on by TalkRadioNews.com. And on January 11th and 12th, I'll be speaking at the Rebooting Democracy Conference here in Portland, Oregon. It's our Brunch with Bernie segment. Senator Bernie Sanders on the line with us, 866-303-2270, our telephone number. And let's see here, Michael in Portland, Oregon, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Yeah, hi, Senator. Good morning.
Hi.
Appreciate you talking about me. I wanted to expound on a topic that you went over last week. About increasing the CAFE standards. I'm somewhat, not totally, but somewhat opposed to it because I think what we need to do first is look at those restrictions we already have in place that prevent us from importing the very same highly economical cars that Japan and Europe citizens can buy now. We have barriers here, and those need to be repealed before we think about forcing the manufacturers to do something that's already being done in Europe.
Well, I think we have a right to insist that the manufacturers in this company, in this country, give us at least the same type of mileage per gallon that exists in Japan and in Europe. As you know, the CAFE standards have not risen in some 20 years. They've been 25 miles per gallon, while technology is now providing cars that can do much, much, much better. But because of the opposition of the automobile industry, we haven't moved forward, and I'm happy to say that while this bill doesn't go anywhere near as far as I would like it to go, we now have passed the bill that will give us 35 miles per gallon if we can get through Republican obstructionism, and I think that is a step in the right direction.
Lee in Edgewood, New Mexico, you're on the air with Senator Bernie Sanders. Lee?
Yes, Lee is here. I got a question for Bernie.
You are on?
Bernie, I want you to know I'm a long-term supporter of yours. Used to live in Vermont. I helped put you in the mayor's office in Burlington and always helped send you to Congress.
Thank you, Lee.
I'm a musician that also played many of your campaign rallies. But here's my thought. The American people seem to me right now to be really, they don't have what we used to call the fire in the belly. for any of the candidates, be they Republican or Democrat. So my question to you, sir, is when are you going to run for president?
Well, thanks very much, Lee. And if you can help me raise a couple of $1 billion for the campaign, we'll run.
That's what it takes these days.
I know. No, I'm very content, and I'm very proud that the people of Vermont have sent me to the United States Senate as the first real independent elected here, I think, in the history of the Senate. And I've got my hands full right here. I think what we have got to do in the next year as we prepare for this election, and I know people will disagree which candidate they like, but I think one thing I would hope that all of the listeners understand is that it would be a disaster for this country to have a president continuing in the same footpaths as George W. Bush. This man will go down in history, as I've said many times, I think, if not being the worst president, certainly one of the worst presidents. And we are seeing, I am seeing this every single day right now, as we try to pass appropriations bills, as we try to pass a farm bill, as we try to pass an energy bill, as we try to pass global warming. Some of us are trying to expand the number of community health centers available so people can get health care. We're trying to lower the cost of prescription drugs. We're trying to get better mileage per gallon for our cars. We're trying to move this country away from fossil fuel to sustainable energy. And on every one of these issues, and dozens more, he is prepared to veto. He is prepared to stop good legislation. And it would be heartbreaking for this country if we had another president who followed in his footsteps. So I know there are differences of opinion. Some people, you know, will like this candidate. Some people like this candidate. But I would hope that we can certainly reverse course in the White House and give us a president who can work with the Congress.
Amen, brother. Brian in Redondo Beach, California. You're on the air with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Good morning, Senator.
Hi.
Morning, Tom.
Hey.
I have a question for you that's really been pressing on my heart. I can't understand for the life of me, why is it that the projects in New Orleans are being knocked down, they're being bulldozed today, and no one is doing anything about it, and Secretary Orlando Jackson, he just sits on the sideline and pretends like he's doing his job, but those projects were nothing wrong with them. They were made of brick, and they were made to withstand a powerful hurricane, which it did. And those people's stuff are still in those homes. Bernie, what can you do for those people today? The bulldozer is there today. This reminds me of the Gaza Strip, where they just bulldozed the Palestinians' homes because they're poor. This has to stop. Where do I live? Is this the United States of America?
Well, Brian, you raised an important issue. I can't tell you I know all of the details there, but I am aware of the concerns that you raised. And I don't know the definitive answer. I mean, there's various types of speculation. The concern is that the number of black people, for example, living in New Orleans will be significantly fewer. And there is some speculation that by not rebuilding that public housing, that becomes a political issue. There are other concerns that some people, contractors, are using Katrina as an opportunity to build touristy-type projects where they can make a whole lot of money rather than put money into affordable housing. But I think that there is widespread concern about almost every aspect of what FEMA has done and what the rebuilding of New Orleans is about.
Teresa in Napa, California. You're on the air with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Hi. I want to thank you both for all that you do. And, Bernie, I really appreciate your words of truth. We're starved for it out here. I'm calling about two things. One is Senate Bill 1959. It reminds me, do you know which one I'm talking about?
Yes, I do. Tom and I were talking about it before we went on the air. Yeah.
Okay. It reminds me of the House Un-American Activities, and I wonder if it's even constitutional. Two specifics out of it that I object to, and I want to hear your thoughts on it, is definition number three, sentence ends with inclusion of people who are U.S. citizens who belong to political organizations could be called in to be questioned by the commission if they are doing anything that has to do with political activity. And as a member of MoveOn.org, I assume that would be me. So, I mean, that's personal. And then under 899B, like baby, it says that the Internet is used for and by terrorists for communications, planning, etc. But there's no caveat in there that states that 99.9% of the U.S. citizens use it for legal purposes, et cetera. There's so much about this bill that concerns me. The vagueness, we don't know who's going to be on the commission. And then it's at one point that it says that after 15 months, it's going to be handed over to a private company. So are we going to have Blackwater interviewing, pulling anyone off the streets they want to for a lot of vague reasons? I'm really concerned.
Well, Teresa, thank you for raising the issue, and I know there is a lot of concern about it. It's not an issue, I have to tell you, that I has gotten a lot of attention here in the Senate. I don't believe there have been any hearings on it yet, to the best of my knowledge. But the concerns that you raise certainly are very, very legitimate, and language like that and legislation like that should certainly not be passed in a democratic society.
Sean in Vancouver, Washington. You're on the air with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Good morning, Senator Sanders. Tom.
Hi.
Guys, last summer I saw the movie Sicko, as I'm sure you did too, and of course it left me in tears, and all I could think of was how our schools are intentionally underfunded and our jails and prisons are filled and, you know, healthcare is just, you know, woefully inadequate for folks. And, you know, like even this week we saw, you know, another breakdown in the mental health care system. My question basically is, you know, no one in their right mind wants to see a recession or a depression, but it seems like so long as we continue to bail out these huge hedge funds and so forth, you've got the frog in the proverbial pot of water, and it's slowly boiling, and it seems like if we didn't bail out Wall Street, people would be forced into attention, and they would at least, you know, do something about, you know, getting involved, becoming activists, getting involved in politics.
Right.
I want to get your response.
Well, Sean, actually, you raised almost the same question that Karen did earlier in the show. What I liked about the movie Sicko was not only that I thought did a very effective job in taking a hard look at our disintegrating healthcare system, and not only looking at people who had no health insurance, but looking at people who were so-called insured, but their insurance was totally inadequate, which is true for tens of millions of people. But the other thing that Michael Moore did, which I thought was good, is begin to give us a glimpse of what exists in other countries in terms of not just in healthcare, but in France and elsewhere in terms of, for example, the programs available to people who are having babies and vacation time and so forth. One of the areas where our media and the political process, and I'm going to focus on this a whole lot in the Senate, has been just terribly silent about, is the fact that in many countries of the world, in Scandinavia, many of the European countries, they have done an extremely good job in eliminating poverty. If you go to Scandinavia, you'll have maybe 3-4% of their children are living in poverty. In our country, 18 or 20%. They have free higher education. They have vacation time for workers that are infinitely more generous than we have in this country. And it's important that we begin to take a look at what some of the more progressive countries in this world are doing.
And try to emulate it.
That's right.
There you go. Senator Bernie Sanders on the line with us. Sanders.senate.gov is website, 866-303-2270, our phone number, 45 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program, your radio support group for We the People.
Minutes before the hour. It's our Brunch with Bernie segment. Senator Bernie Sanders, the independent from Vermont. Bernie, is it true the first independent senator in the history of the Senate?
That's what we believe, who was not affiliated with a major party. That's right.
That's wonderful. I know you were the longest serving independent in the House of Representatives. It's remarkable. Anyhow, but get back to our phone lines here, 1-866-303-2270. Our number is Stephen in Gaithersburg, Maryland. Stephen, you're on with Senator Sanders.
Tom and Senator Sanders, thank you for taking my call. I know you're not a Dem, but you do caucus with them. Is that the right word?
Yes.
What I'm concerned about is how bad the Dems in Congress are making the rest of us look. how ineffective, ineffectual. It's specifically the campaign promises of the work week, the PAYGO rules, ethics, earmarks, and I see that we caved again last night on the PAYGO rules, and I'm not sure why that's happening.
Okay, that's a good question, Stephen. Isn't it?
Specifically, I think the Dems are going to lose the PR battle anyway. Why not make a stand that you promised us we'd make, and go down, ethically at least.
Well, I think the dilemma that you're raising is what Tom Hartman just talked about a little while ago. I think you have a leader and leadership here that actually wants to accomplish something, whether it is improving education in America, improving health care, lowering the cost of prescription drugs. And at every turn, they are being frustrated by the Republicans who have used a record-breaking number of filibusters for 1 year. This is today we had their 57th filibuster. And I think it's important to place blame where blame belongs, and that is on a president who did not veto one piece of legislation, not one, when the Republicans were in power for 6 years, but now is prepared to veto almost everything that the Democratic leadership here is, and that we're trying to pass. That's really, in fairness, Stephen, where the blame should be placed. And you can disagree. We can disagree about tactics. But I think we must be clear who is obstructing progress right now in this country. So what I think we've got to do at this point is do the best that we can in making sure that we have a farm bill that has increased nutrition for our children, that we continue to protect the needs of our senior citizens and our veterans and the most vulnerable people in this country, and most importantly, I think we have got to build a strong grassroots progressive movement which will elect people to the House and the Senate who are ready to take on the big money interests who have so much influence both in the White House and in the Congress. I think that's what we have got to do. And I think it's wrong to say, stop blaming the Democratic leadership here when you have a record-breaking number of filibusters on the part of the Republicans.
Yeah, we need to stop the circular firing squad. Tom in San Diego, you're on the air with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Hey, thanks, Tom. Thanks, Senator Sanders. For less than 1% of the price of a new car, every car could be flex fuel. Was there anything in the energy bill that requires the car makers to allow every car to be flex fuels? It's just changing the computer chip and the line so they can handle alcohol.
I can't give you my impression is that there is, and there's certainly an language in the energy bill to demand that in this country we use a lot more biofuel. So I think I don't know what the exact language is, but in general the answer is absolutely that we want to break our dependence on gas and oil, that we want to move to biofuels, and that legislation does that.
Yeah, I mean, just look at Brazil. More than half of all the cars in Brazil right now are fueled by biofuels and ethanol.
That is so important. It's important in terms of energy independence, not having to import more oil from the Middle East. It's important for the environment and the greenhouse gas emissions that oil allows.
Amen. Danny in Torrance, California. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hi. Good morning. First comment that I want to make is, a while back, Bush passed a law where he could declare somebody a terrorist and freeze their assets. And Blackwater is currently under investigation whether they were smuggling illegal weapons into Iraq. So I'd like to know why their assets have not been frozen until the end of this investigation. That's number one. Number two, with the lying that's been going on in this war, leading up to war with Iran, is somebody guilty of treason? I looked up the definition in the dictionary, and it sounds like somebody somewhere is guilty of treason. And the last comment that I want to make is, I've only heard Dennis Kucinich say that he's willing to file charges against the lawbreakers of this administration the minute he gets into the White House. And are any other candidates willing to make that a statement?
Well, I think right now what you're beginning to see is after 6 years of rubber stamping what the Bush administration did in the Senate Judiciary Committee, in the House Judiciary Committee, in the House Government Reform Committee under Congressman Waxman, you are seeing an extraordinary number of investigations going on right now about what the Bush administration has done. And, you know, I think that what we have to do is to put things into a political perspective. We have a long way to go to turn this country around. But I also want to remind people where we were a year ago. And a year ago today, we had right-wing extremists running the House, right-wing extremists running the Senate, and a right-wing extremist in the White House. We have a long way to go, and I hope that this next election will give us more, larger numbers in the Senate, larger numbers in the House, and most importantly, a new president and a strong grassroots movement to fundamentally change the direction of this country.
From your lips to God's ears. Thank you, Bernie.
All right, Tom.
Senator Bernie Sanders, sanders.senate.gov. Always great having you on. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
You too. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program. Anything Goes Friday. I'm coming up, your phone calls on any topic you want to talk about. Telemarketers? Stick around. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, the No Boring Zone. Tom Hartman. This is the Tom Hartman Program. Tom Hartman. Where smart people get their news.
Welcome back. A couple of things here that I'd like to riff on, and then we'll just, you know, open up the phone lines and get into your phone calls. The first is this whole subprime mortgage thing. The issue that is not being talked about, the best of the rest of the news, as it were, the issue that the mainstream media is not talking about, or if they are, at least not in a way that makes any sense to anybody, is the legal issue that's involved from the point of view of banks and investors. And there's you know, today in the Washington Post, for example, front page piece, long story about, you know, this guy who decided not to buy a house during the housing bubble because he was going to save up and have a good, you know, large, substantial down payment and get a conventional 30-year note or 20-year mortgage at a fixed rate, and he was going to do it the right way, and he was just going to live out, you know, wait out the housing bubble, and now he's like, oh, these people who you know, have these arms and things, they're being bailed out, you know, this isn't fair to me. And this has been the kind of focus of these things. I mean, yeah, we can have this debate all day long about whether it's appropriate to bail out people, whether they're the victims of predators or not. Should we blame the victims if they are the victims, or should, you know, or is it deregulation? What's the, and of course there's an awful lot of emphasis, a huge attempt, frankly, I'd say, by the big corporate media and their friends, the big corporate banks, to blame the media, to blame the victims in this. But there's a larger issue that nobody's talking about. Bush yesterday or day before came out and said, oh, well, you know, we need to have this voluntary program where adjustable rate mortgages are frozen for a small segment of people who actually are making their payments and who actually can't afford to make their payments. In other words, it wasn't even helping out the people who might be the actual victims of fraud or of high-pressure sales techniques or you know, just didn't realize what they were getting into because it was their first home. That guy doesn't even help those people, number one. And secondly, it really doesn't help anybody because it's entirely voluntary. And this is the kicker. Let's say, just for the sake of argument, that you're an investor, that you've got $100,000 in your 401k. It's your life savings, and you're going to invest that money. And you go to an investment counselor, and he says, well, there's, you know, Citibank is offering a good investment package. It's a kind of an investment vehicle that you can buy into. It's like buying a stock in a stock market. You can buy into this thing, and if it's producing a return of 5% a year or 7% a year, it's got a really good return on it. And so, you know, why don't you buy that? And so you buy that. And I shouldn't say Citibank because, this could be from anywhere. So just, you know, Company X. And so you buy it, expecting that you're going to get that 7% return because they have represented to you that what they're selling is an investment vehicle which is really a whole bunch of mortgages that have been bundled together into one giant bundle and then, you know, worth, say, 50 million or 50 billion or what. Let's say it's $100 million worth of mortgages that have all been bundled together. And because a lot of them are adjustable rate mortgages, they start out at 3%, they're going to end up at 8 or 9%. So over the lifetime of the mortgage, it's, say, an average of 7%. They say, yeah, we'll give you a return of 7%. You're going to get this. This is the return you're going to get on your investment. And you put your money into that. And then the bank says to all the people who have those adjustable rate mortgages, okay, we're going to be nice to you and say your mortgage payment is not going to go up. We're not going to adjust up your adjustable rate mortgage, even though that we legally can. What's going to happen to the people who invested in them? Whether it's you with your 401k or whether it's General Motors with, you know, $1 billion, or whether it's mail, you know, Michael Bloomberg with his billions of dollars, or Willard Romney, putting in millions of dollars. I mean, whether it's some rich investor or it's some average investor, what's the investor going to say? The investor's going to say, hey, wait a minute, I was promised a certain return on my investment. I want that return on my investment. And you're going to see lawsuits from investors, whether they're banks in Abu Dhabi or whether they're average people. You're going to see investor lawsuits saying, no, you cannot change the terms of those agreements that are going to determine the result, the return on investment of this vehicle. So the banks are in a bind. The banks and the mortgage companies, they're caught between these two forces. On the one hand, if they don't give people some breathing room, they're going to see more defaults, which is going to further crash the value of the investments, could crash the entire system. If they do give people relief, they put themselves at legal risk. This is why what we really need is actual legislation to deal with this, not the president saying, oh, why don't you guys voluntarily do something? And here's our guidelines. Here's what we'd like you to voluntarily do. Ain't going to work. It ain't going to work. No bank, no mortgage company is going to voluntarily say, oh, we'll take a lower rate of return on our investment because they view loaning you money for a mortgage as an investment. We'll take a lower rate of return just for the hell of it. They're not going to do that. They're not going to say that. The only conditions under which they may adjust the mortgage is if they think that if they don't, then you're going to default. And then, well, okay, it's better to have 4% than no percent. Or to have the house back, which costs, you know, a negative percentage when all is said and done. So what is really needed here, frankly, I mean, you know, you get to the base of this, what never should have been done in the first place is Bill Clinton pushing through and then signing the legislation that rolled back the Glass-Steagall Act, which made it illegal for banks to also be in the brokerage business, basically. Which is one of the things that got us into this. And the second, you know, all this massive deregulation of the banking industry that led to these predators coming along and starting, you know, off-the-shelf mortgage companies when really they weren't offering mortgages. They were just, you know, they were putting together packages that they were then reselling and not holding the paper. So anyhow, those are my thoughts on that. And I don't see anybody taking a real genuine leadership role on this. And that concerns me, frankly, because this thing, these mortgages, I mean, we've got another 5 years of adjustable rate mortgages, at least another three solidly years where these things are going to continue blowing up. It's like 3 years of landmines in front of us. The second thing I wanted to share with you very quickly is a statement that I just received from the office of Ted Kennedy. And I'm just going to just read this straight out. This is from Ted Kennedy. He said, this is a speech he gave on the floor of the Senate. The torture debate took another deeply troubling, and you probably won't see it in the mainstream media for reasons that are obvious. The torture debate took another deeply troubling turn yesterday, says Ted Kennedy. The nation learned the CIA had destroyed videotapes of its employees in the act of using torture or other harsh interrogation techniques on detainees. Those tapes were not shown to Congress. They were not shown to any court. They were not shown to the bipartisan 9/11 Commission. Instead, they were destroyed. What would cause the CIA to take this action? The answer is obvious: cover-up. The agency was desperate to cover up damning evidence of their practices. In a letter to agency employees yesterday, CIA Director Michael Hayden claimed that the tapes were a security risk because they might someday leak and therefore thereby identify the CIA employees who engaged in these practices. But that excuse won't wash. I am second to no one in wanting to protect the brave men and women of the CIA. But how is it possible that the director of the CIA has so little faith in his own agency? Does the director believe the CIA's buildings are not secure? Would it be beyond the agency's technical expertise to preserve the tapes while hiding the identity of its employees? Does the director believe that the CIA's employees cannot be trusted not to leak materials that might harm the agency? Or does he know that the interrogation techniques are so abhorrent that they could not remain unknown for much longer? It is particularly difficult to take the director's explanation at face value when the news that these CIA tapes were destroyed came the very same week that we learned as many as 10 million White House emails have also not been preserved, despite a law that requires their retention. At the same time, the president continued to insist that we grant immunity to the phone companies for their role in the illegal wiretapping of American citizens. The pattern is unmistakable. The past 6 years, the Bush administration has run roughshod over our ideals and the rule of law. For four of those 6 years, the Republican Congress did little to hold the administration accountable. Now, when the new Democratic Congress is demanding answers, the administration is feverishly covering up its tracks. We haven't seen anything like this since the 18-and-a-half-minute gap in the tapes of President Richard Nixon. These efforts are wrong, and they must be stopped. I and other concerned senators will today call upon Attorney General Will Casey to immediately begin an investigation into whether the CIA's handling and destruction of these tapes violated the law. He says, as founder John Adams said, our nation is a nation of laws, not men. That basic principle is at risk today from an administration that is engaging in a cover-up. God bless you, Ted Kennedy. 16 minutes past the hour.
Hartman Program, transforming the world by revitalizing democracy.
In olden days, a glimpse of stocky was looked on as something shocking. Now heaven knows, anything goes.
Anything goes Friday. We'll be getting to your calls in just a minute. A quick reminder, next Friday, December 14th, I'll be at the University of Minnesota Bookstore at Kauffman Memorial Union in Minneapolis, Minnesota. And I'll have an opportunity even to head through the Minneapolis airport and see if I can find the famous Larry Craig bathroom. Also, January 7th and 8th, we'll be in Manchester, New Hampshire. I'll be doing the show live from the New Hampshire Primary Radio Row, organized by Talk Radio News, talkradionews.com. And on January 11th and 12th, I'll be speaking at the Rebooting Democracy Conference here in Portland. Ellen Ratner on the line. Ellen, you say you have breaking news for us.
The breaking news is from the press briefing today done by Dana Perino, and this regards the tapes that you were just talking about. And first of all, the president, she said, did not know about the tapes. He did not know about their destruction. But more importantly, the president has no recollection about these tapes.
Oh, man. So this is what they say. This is what they say when they're trying not. This is what Bill Clinton should have said rather than saying no. He should have said, I don't remember.
Exactly. He also said that he has full confidence in General Hayden. Of course, General Hayden, to be fair, was not there at the time that these were supposedly destroyed, but that the White House now has no additional comments because there's an internal investigation and the White House is cooperating with it. Well, of course there's going to be an internal investigation, so they don't have to comment on it.
Wow. Are we any closer? I don't know if you saw Keith Olbermann's rant last night, or riff, you know, I mean that in the very best sense, about George Bush not being fit to be president and demonstrating that he's lied to us. The timeline of, you know, his changing back in the summer, after apparently he was notified that this NIE was coming down and that Iran had no nuclear program, he stopped talking about their nuclear program and started talking about knowledge of, you know, his rhetoric changed substantially, and yet he's claiming that he only learned about this, you know, on Wednesday of last week, when, you know, there's some reports that he briefed Ehud Olmert about it on Monday. And as Keith Olbermann pointed out, he's been talking differently since August, when apparently he was first told about this. Anything new on that?
No, I mean, I haven't gotten anything new.
Dana didn't deal with it today in the press conference?
I was not at the press conference. I was actually at the United Nations, but Lavisa called me immediately because she thought that you and everybody else ought to know about this. She just said, it is so hot there now at the press conferences, you can't even believe it. I mean, this has that sort of frenzy to it.
Yeah.
And I was actually at the White House yesterday, but I wasn't there today. The frenzy is now involved, and I was there yesterday as this tape thing broke, but the frenzy that...
It's like there's blood in the water.
It's just like what happened with Bill Clinton. It is that they do smell. They smell blood in the water, and they're going after it.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I think there's a lot of... Maybe that's the wrong... maybe that's not the spiffiest metaphor, but there are so many crimes that this administration has committed that are just kind of laying around on the ground to look at. It would be extraordinary. It'd be a wonderful thing, I think, to see some of them being exposed and discussed. And even if it's just, I mean, you just never know when they begin pulling the thread that, you know, which thread it is that's going to have the whole sweater unravel. Whether it's going to be the destruction of the CIA torture tapes, or whether it's going to be Bush lying about when he knew that Iran has no nuclear program, or what, you know. But Ellen, thanks so much for calling and sharing that with us.
Thank you. I just thought you ought to have it hot off the press.
I appreciate it. Great to hear from you. Thank you. Ellen Ratner of the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Mike in Phoenix, Arizona. Hey, Mike, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. How are you doing today?
Just great, but I'll get better. What's up, Mike?
Hey, Tom. Tom, I just want to mention that to talk the fuel economy, we have to acknowledge that primarily fuel economy is based on the weight of the vehicle.
Mm-hmm.
In all the calculations that you would use, the physics, the way to bring down the fuel economy, to take the fuel economy up, is to take down the weight of the vehicle.
Right.
Now, concerns with safety are, you know, impact equals mass times momentum. Now, we somewhat control the momentum through speed limits, the velocity of the vehicle.
Right. But the less mass you have, the less mass there is to absorb the kinetic energy from that impact, and thus more of it gets transmitted to the people inside.
There you go. Exactly, Tom. Yeah. And on the one side of the equation, of course, the velocity is controlled through the speed limits on the roads. Then the other side of the equation, the mass, like you just said, is associated with the weight of the vehicle. Now, we used to...
Why is it, though, you know, I lived in Germany for a year. On the Autobahn, there are no speed limits at all. I've driven 130, 140 miles an hour on that thing. It's amazing. And when they have accidents, and they used to have them almost every day on the stretch between Nuremberg and Munich that I used to drive regularly, there would be a 100, 150-car pileup, and nobody would die. It was just amazing that you have these incredible crashes, and everybody walks away. Their cars are lighter... And at some level, because of that weight thing, some of them don't meet our safety standards, and yet they don't have the problem of people dying in their cars.
Well, exactly it, sir. And as you know, in Europe, they put a heavy tax on the cylinder size. The bigger the cylinder size, the heavier the car. They've been taxing that since World War II, accordingly.
Yeah. Plus, they have a heavy tax on the gasoline. I mean, this is a $4 a gallon gas tank. Mike, we're out of time. But thank you very much for the call and for raising the issue. 27 minutes past the hour.
You're tuned in to the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Radio.
Anything goes Friday, 34 minutes past the hour. I think I just answered my own question. Why is it that in Europe, when you have these big car wrecks, more people don't get killed? It's because all of the cars are lighter, and therefore you don't have people being smashed into by giant, monstrous SUVs carrying enormous amounts of mass, converting that kinetic energy into crush forces that, you know, kill people in cars. That's my theory anyway. 1-866-303-2270, your telephone number. Chris in Michigan. Hey, Chris.
Hey, Tom. I wanted to talk to you about universal health care.
Sure.
I understand when you say we should be a we society, not a me society. And I have no problem using my taxpayer dollars to help somebody who gets into a car accident, needs a flu shot, or is born with asthma. My question for you, though, is this. How is it fair for we, the people, to also cover the medical expenses of people who smoke, do drugs, have unprotected sex, and don't eat right? Why should we, the people, have to cover the medical expenses of people who knowingly commit acts that have been proven time and time again to drive up the cost of their medical use in their life?
Do you, the flip side of that, Chris, is do you really think that high hospital bills, that, I mean, are you really believe that you can walk up to somebody who's using drugs or somebody who's smoking or somebody who's eating poorly and say, you know, someday your hospital bills are going to be really high and they're going to stop that behavior?
No, but why, but they,
then why would you want to use the cost of medical services as your incentive to them to not engage in that behavior?
I'm sorry?
Then why, if you don't think that that's going to cause them to stop that behavior or change that behavior, then why would you argue in favor of using the cost of medicine as the incentive against that behavior?
Well, I'm not talking about stopping them from doing it themselves.
Well, that's the argument you're making.
But do you not believe that those people who smoke for 20 years are going to go into the doctor and say, well, I need universal health care because I can't afford these pills and these oxygen tank I have to carry around?
Well, of course they are. But the argument that you're making is at its core is that the way that you modify people's behavior that you don't want, that the only way that you modify it is by making the consequences of that behavior so expensive that they can't afford it. And I think that we can agree that it doesn't actually work that way, that people are not thinking about cancer when they start smoking. And frankly, the consequences of cancer from diabetes, you know, going blind, losing your toes, things like that, from obesity, the consequences of dying from AIDS as a consequence of unprotected sex, those consequences vastly outweigh the consequence associated with having to pay a high hospital bill. So withholding medical assistance from people simply because they engaged in behavior that you may disagree with or that we all agree, and they would probably even agree, is ultimately destructive, is dumb. I just don't get it. I don't get why you would want to do that. I agree
because
that as a society
affect the individual, where if those consequences affect the individual, but if I'm paying for their medicine, then their consequences also affect me because then I have to pay more in taxes to help those people.
You're absolutely right. So as a society, what we should do is we should say, since we're all now paying for the medical expenses of people who are smoking and people who are eating inappropriately and people who are engaging in sexually risky behavior, since we're all paying for that stuff, then we all should figure out what's the most effective, efficient, cost-effective, and actually, you know, works way to cause people to no longer engage in these behaviors. And that's one of the reasons why you see in countries like France, where they have national health care, or Germany, you see preventative medicine programs that are very aggressive. You see anti-smoking programs that are very aggressive. You see, it's like when you invest in early childhood education, you get back that investment tenfold because people end up producing more taxes, being more productive members of society down the road. Similarly, providing everybody with health care and then investing a small amount of money in preventing people or causing people not to engage in behavior that's going to end up burdening the healthcare system will produce a huge return.
But wouldn't we be getting the cart in front of the horse? Shouldn't we try preventing it before we pay for everything?
I think we should do both at the same time. We can walk and chew gum.
Some of us can.
Yeah, there you go. Well, I think.
Well, thank you, Tom. Appreciate having you.
You're welcome. Thank you, Chris. I appreciate the call. Pervez, if I'm pronouncing that right, in Larchmont.
Yes.
Pervez? Hey,
Pervez.
What's up? Oh, Pervez. I'm sorry. What's up?
Problem. Yeah, I want to talk about Iran. You know, it seems neocons are not happy that Iran does not have a nuclear program. They're writing editorials. They're saying, oh, it's a disaster. They're very sad.
Yeah, we had John Bolton on the program a couple of days ago. He's this must be a lie that they don't have a program because, these are people pursuing a political agenda in the White House.
You know the reason. The reason is this. You know, during the Shah's regime, United States prevented Iran from having a steel plant. They said, you can buy steel from us. Why do you want to make a steel? They said, well, we want to be industrialized. Iran is getting industrialized. It's going to compete with the world. They don't want them to compete. France, Germany, U.S., West, they want to keep the developing countries agrarian so they can dominate us all the time.
And yeah, as long as you've got oil to pump out of the ground.
Yeah. I mean, it's immoral. It's unethical. And regarding the tapes, Naomi Wolf's book, I just finished reading it, The End of America, and she says that we should, as patriots, save our country, and we have to really do drastic actions to stop these guys from destroying our country. They're destroying our democracy, destroying our constitution. Look at all the unconstitutional things they're doing. This rendition, this torturing, this is going to destroy the reputation of America and put all of us as Americans on the harm's way. Because I, as an American, when I travel with my American passport, they're going to capture me and they're going to torture me in order to revenge what we are doing to these innocent people. And a lot of them are innocent because they were obtained or they were captured on the bounties, and those unscrupulous people wanted to make money. So they got money and sold these to Americans, and it's just like slavery, you know.
I understand Pervez, and I perfectly understand. And in fact, there's a company out there. There's probably a couple of them now, but there's one that I know of. I'm on their email list that is selling phony passports for countries that no longer exist, like British Guyana and Zimbabwe, the countries that no longer exist, that you can get a passport for, saying that you're a citizen of that country, and when you're traveling, if you're an American traveling outside the United States, you carry that passport in your pocket, you know, and hide your U.S. passport. Yeah. So if some guy gets on the bus or gets on the plane and says, okay, I want all the Americans, show your passports, I want to find the Americans, you can say, I'm not an American, I live in Zimbabwe, or I live in British Guyana. Yeah. It's bizarre. So, you know, your point is well made and well taken, and it's not just that they may harm the United States, the reputation of the United States. They already have. They've already done incredible damage to us. And I'll just leave it at that. Bill in New York. Hey, Bill, what's up? Bill, you're on the air.
Hello.
Hey, what's up? Bill, you need to be listening to your telephone, not your radio. You're on the air. Maybe Bill can't hear me. I don't know. So let's see if Scott and Gresham can get on the line. Hey, Scott, can you hear me?
Hello, Tom.
Hey, Scott, what's up?
Yeah, I wanted to talk about plug-in hybrids.
Okay.
Well, I mean, you own a Prius, don't you?
I do, and I understand probably in another year or two they're going to make a plug-in version of it. I'm not up for $10,000 to turn this into one and void the warranty right now. And
yeah, me either. I also got a Prius for this year, and I don't work for Toyota. But, my understanding is that the Toyota is actually test-driving them in Japan as we speak.
Yeah, and in a year or two when they come out, I'll be at the front of the line to trade mine in.
Me too. And the point I wanted to bring up is that we should start a conversation when we're talking about energy independence. The nexus between the transportation infrastructure and also just the vehicles, and then the nexus between oil and gas, it really comes down to things like plug-in hybrids, where if you plug it into your wall outlet in your garage, then you have to be interested in where does your electric power company get its electricity from? Does it generate it from nuclear power, coal, gas, or renewable energy?
Right. Yeah, absolutely right, Scott. And then also, who owns that?
Or privately owned. Last thing, Tom, and it's nice talking to you again.
Yeah.
Nebraska is the only state in the country that is 100% publicly owned nonprofit electric utilities, and I'd love to hear more about that, perhaps a future show idea.
Yeah, well, as you well know, Scott, and you and I over the last couple of years have talked about these issues many times, particularly when you used to work with us on the local show, is that it's very efficient, it's very effective, it's very cost-effective, that publicly owned utilities will almost always outperform privately owned, corporately owned utilities in terms of both the service that they're providing people and their expenses. And, you know, you're the expert on the stuff.
Well, thank you. Tom, it's nice talking to you. You take care.
Scott, thank you very much.
Goodbye.
I appreciate the call. Bill in New York. Hey, Bill, we've got about a minute before the break. What's up? Oh, Bill still can't hear me. Okay, let's go to Zeph in Los Angeles. Hey, Zeph.
Hello.
Hey, you're on the air.
Hello.
You are on the air, Zeph.
Yeah, I can hear you. Hi.
I just want to just educate your audience on how to talk to telemarketers. How about that?
Okay.
I was listening the other day, cracking up, and I know from experience that people don't know how to talk to telemarketers, and they get all kinds of head games about what the purpose is and everything. First of all, that's America calling. That's America calling. That's Willie Loman calling. You know.
Yeah, I know. I know.
And second of all, there's only one way to handle a telemarketer: say no and hang up. They respect that. They get on to the next guy. It's a numbers game. You know,
yeah,
you,
good
want,
point,
you don't
Seth,
want your time to be wasted. He doesn't want his time to be wasted.
Yeah, good point. And that's, you know, typically what I do, except when I'm awakened. 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, where despair is not an option. Get active.
Here's another song from GW, that's me, and the Carlisle Group. Here we go, get real close. Strangers in the night, exchanging gunfire, liberals so uptight, call me a liar, challenging my war, before my term is through.
Oh, sing it, George.
Something in their eyes is getting scary. Keeping to my plan is getting hairy. Every day it's hard to do the things I do.
It's hard work, ain't it, George?
Justify my fight. Please, Limbaugh, Hannity, O'Reilly on the right. Keep my agenda on the burners burning bright. Because I'm so uptight, demonize the left today and take their right to speak away. And if you all succeed, we'll satisfy your hunger and your greed with all the corporate dollars that you need. And some pretty little strangers in the night.
9 minutes before the hour. Thank you, George. Enough already. Oh, my. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. By the way, Sheldon Whitehouse on the floor of the Senate just gave an impassioned speech about FISA and all this kind of stuff. And he actually, as a consequence of his being a senator and whatnot, was able to see some of the Justice Department's Office of Legal Counsel's secret opinions about what kind of power the president has. And according to the president's Justice Department, the president is the guy who is makes up his own rules. An executive order cannot limit him. So if a previous president has said, you know, the president can't do this, simply by doing it, he has changed the law. He also, exercising his constitutional authority under Article 2, can determine whether an action is a lawful exercise of his authority under Article 2. In other words, the president gets to be the Supreme Court. This is totally bizarre. Christy in Ann Arbor, Michigan on WLBY. Hey, Christy.
Hello?
Hey, Christy, you're on the air.
Hey, Tom, I'm calling from Michigan,
mm-hmm.
and I'm really concerned about the fact that Michigan is holding a primary in January, and apparently it's against the rules of the Democratic National Committee.
Right.
Therefore, no one is campaigning in Michigan. I think there may be one or two names on the ballot, people who didn't get their names off in time. We have lost all of our delegates.
Right. Another state that this has also happened to. I don't remember which one it is right now, but I know about Michigan.
Well, no one's talking about it. And Michigan, with its horrible financial situation, seems to me to be an important state, and we're going to waste all this money on a primary that doesn't count.
Yeah, I agree. It's a disaster and it's a tragedy. And what it is, my understanding of it, and I may be wrong on this, and if somebody has, you know, more current or more accurate information, let me know. But this is my understanding is that basically the Democratic Party in Michigan thought, okay, if we can have an early primary, then that's going to get the candidates into the state. It's going to get our issues out there in the forefront. It's going to bring money into the state in terms of advertising dollars and hotel room nights and things like, you know, the candidates are staying, and it'll be all good for Michigan. And yes, there is a party rule against this, but if we say, what the heck, we're going to do it anyway, the party will flinch and back away from that rule. And so Michigan went ahead and did that. The Michigan Democratic Party went ahead and did that. And the National Party did not flinch and did not back away. And so now the Michigan Democratic Party is left with egg on its face.
It's terrible.
Yeah, it is. It's one of those tragic situations. And you know, I in terms of heroes and villains in the story, I don't know who is what. But it's a real shame. And in fact, I'll be in Michigan the weekend after this, next weekend.
Where?
I'm just going to be visiting my family. I grew up in Lansing, and I'm going back to see my mom and my three brothers and, you know, uncles and nieces and nephews and whatnot. I'll be in Minneapolis.
Well, thanks for the time. I just had to say I'm really angry about it.
Yeah, a lot of people are very concerned about it. Christy, thank you very much. I appreciate the call, and thanks for listening there. Dan in Colorado Springs, Colorado. Hey, Dan, what's up?
Hi, how's it going today?
Just great. What's up?
One quick point before I get to my major point. I'm convinced that as soon as big oil can get their hands into alternative energy sources, as far as fueling cars, that those hybrid vehicles will drop in price significantly.
Yeah, you know who's the largest manufacturer of solar panels in the world right now?
Exactly.
British Petroleum.
My major point is I was watching the Republican debate on YouTube the other day, and I saw Huckabee, in response to a retired general's opinion on homosexuality in the Army, say that to me what I got out of it was that heterosexual Judeo-Christians have more of a right to serve in the military than anyone else.
Yeah.
And I kind of thought that was kind of somewhat appalling.
I think it's somewhat bigoted. I agree with Barry Goldwater. You don't have to be straight to shoot straight.
Yeah, no, and patriotism to me has no lifestyle, creed, or gender.
Yeah, no.
And my final question to you is, why do Republicans hate the World Trade Organization so much?
Republicans hate the World Trade Organization? They love the World Trade Organization.
I've seen on
they hate the United Nations.
It was, but went through conservative views of the Republican candidates, and many of them said they would eliminate or take us out of the World Trade Organization. Is this true?
Huh. I have not seen any Republicans say that they'd take us out of the WTO. And I know some Democrats have, John Edwards, Dennis Kucinich, but most Republicans just want to get us out of the UN. George in Woodland Hills, California. Hey, George, you got about a little less than a minute here before we got to wrap up this hour.
Scalia was questioning one of the attorneys for the detainees at Guantanamo, and he asked him, reference any time in the history of the United States where they gave habeas corpus rights to the aliens. And I thought that was kind of a weird, he's trying to circumvent the issue of the habeas rights for even probably American citizens.
Right. We've always given habeas rights to aliens.
That's right. So the thing is, this is the same judge that stopped the vote in the recount in Florida.
That's right.
And then a week later he said he's sorry. Yeah, had he thought about it and he knew more facts, he wouldn't have done it. But the point is there any way of impeaching this guy? Because he seems to be finding a way to circumvent the Constitution.
Scalia?
Rather to
yeah, if there's a Supreme Court justice who deserves to be impeached, it is Scalia, in my opinion. I don't think that there's any easy way to do it, though. 57 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program.
Tom Hartman.
Where smart people get their news.
Is the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Political prisoners. Yeah, Fidel Castro has them, right? Political prisoners. Joe Stalin used to have political prisoners. Well, they probably have political prisoners in Burma, they're political. I mean, you associate political prisoners with dictatorships, right? Larissa Alexandrovna is with us. Arguably, in my opinion, one of the best investigative reporters in the United States. The managing editor of the investigative news at rawstory.com. Larissa, welcome to the program and happy birthday.
Oh, well, thank you. Thank you very much.
We have a political prisoner in the United States, if your investigative reporting is accurate.
It would appear that way, yes. And he's not the only one, but the activities surrounding him are by far the most outrageous and visible.
And people, you know, I think a lot of people think, well, if somebody gets into high political office, they're relatively immune from becoming a political prisoner. This guy was the governor of Alabama,
right.
Don Siegelman.
Correct. And in 2002, he was running against, he's a Democrat, he was running against a Republican by the name of Bob Riley. And by all accounts, Siegelman appeared to have won the election. But sometime over the course of the evening, his opponent actually won. There were these mysterious ballots that suddenly appeared.
They were actually electronic, weren't they? Wasn't it one of the electronic voting machines suddenly discovered that it
had
15,000 more votes?
Well, no. Overall, the state was using some electronic type of voting equipment, but these were actually paper ballots.
Uh-huh.
Okay. And they appeared out of nowhere, and Governor Siegelman wanted a recount, but the Alabama Attorney General, Bill Pryor, had them sealed.
Hmm.
So there was no recount. Those ballots are still sealed. And Bill Pryor was the following April appointed in a recess appointment to the circuit as a judge. So
he got a judgeship for life in exchange for that service, apparently.
Well, I mean, I can't say that. It could be interpreted that way, yeah.
So how did Don Siegelman then? So first of all, he gets the election stolen from him by a Republican. And then, and this is during the Bush administration, and there's a U.S. attorney presumably down there. How does he then become a political prisoner?
Okay. There is a U.S. attorney there by the name of Leora Canary. Her husband, Bill Canary, was running Bob Riley's campaign.
Bob Riley being the Republican who beat Don Siegelman for the governorship.
Yes, and you're going to have, I mean, I think people are going to have to take notes because it gets really complicated. We actually made a graph to help folks out. As soon as Leora Canary comes into office, as soon as she's put into the U.S. Attorney's office, she begins investigating Siegelman, hoping to find something. So they come up with some flimsy charges around the time of the first there's two indictments around the time of the first indictment, which was around the time of the election.
Mm-hmm.
The judge throws out the investigation of the prosecutors and holds the prosecutors in contempt.
really?
Yeah.
This is the U.S. attorney.
Yes.
Who is the wife of the guy who ran the Republican for governor, who arguably maybe stole the election, who ran his campaign?
Yeah. Well, what's interesting is that this guy Canary also ran the reelection campaign of the attorney general who sealed the ballots.
Hmm.
And he ran it with someone you may have heard of by the name of Karl Rove.
Oh my.
Right. So after Siegelman concedes, a couple years go by. He then decides to run again, and suddenly there's a whole new series of indictments. And he loses the Democratic primary and ends up basically in a mock trial, because to actually believe that this was anything remotely resembling a U.S. courtroom is impossible. The judge on the trial is someone who was a big Riley supporter. Riley is the Republican governor. The judge on the trial, we find out from a whistleblower from the Riley campaign, a Republican whistleblower by the name of Jill Simpson, we find out that the judge, Fuller, his name is Mark Fuller, was agreed upon before there were indictments even.
Mm-hmm.
It was agreed upon that he would be the judge on the case.
This is incredible.
Right.
This is like something out of a third world country.
Right. On top of this, you get jury tampering during the trial. That is very convincing. There are two members of the jury who are communicating with one another and other people. This is brought to the judge's attention, and he does nothing about it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's it. He's found guilty and basically sent out of state on this odyssey from prison to prison in various states. He's not even allowed to be out on appeal while he's appealing. And so he's been imprisoned now for about a year.
And it looks like his crime was objecting to have his governorship taken from him by election fraud, by the guy whose wife was the prosecutor who prosecuted him,
right.
and was helped in this by and the guy whose wife was the prosecutor was also in charge of, along with Karl Rove, of the reelection campaign. Oh, this is incredible.
That's why we made a chart. It's almost impossible to summarize it, but basically what you have is you have a lot of conflict of interest at best, if that's what you know. I mean,
so we got Don Siegelman is a political prisoner. The former governor of Alabama is, and why is it the Congress? I mean, the thing that I kept saying back when the U.S. attorney scandal first broke, you know, that they fired these seven or nine or whatever it was attorneys, U.S. attorneys, because they wouldn't go along with the program. I
mm-hmm.
said that's not where we should be looking. Where
exactly.
we should be looking is the ones who were not fired. What the hell were they doing that they shouldn't have been doing? And this seems like it's right at the top of the list. This Mrs. Canary, who was, you know, prosecuting the former governor of Alabama for the heinous crime of contesting an election that was stolen from him
and daring to run again. But he's not the only one. There's a Supreme Court justice in Mississippi who also faced the same kind of shenanigans by the name of Oliver Diaz. I mean, we've basically been finding a lot of similarities here across the country, and it is very disturbing. And the fact that Congress is—I understand Congress is involved.
Could this be one of the reasons, Larissa? We're talking with Larissa Alexandrovna, who is the managing editor of Investigative News over at RawStory.com and one of the best investigative reporters in the United States. Larissa, could this be one of the reasons why so many Democratic elected officials seem unwilling to take on this administration? Because they look at Don Siegelman and they say, here's a guy who was the governor of a state. He won an election. At the last minute, they find some ballots in the middle of the night and say, oh, no, you didn't win. They steal the election from him. He speaks out and says, maybe I'll run for re-election in 2 years or 4 years or whatever it is. And they say, oh, no, you won't. And they throw his butt in jail. Could
right.
it be that these guys, because the Republican Party is being run like an organized crime syndicate, it's being run like the mafia, you know, for goodness sake, that's why so many Democrats are afraid to speak out?
It's possible. I honestly can't say why so many Democrats are afraid to speak out. But
Well, apparently Don Siegelman should have been afraid to speak out.
Well, no, it's not. You know, my whole thing is, my concern here is, even now, while he's in prison, while they have him put away, and he's been moved around, while his attorneys have been told he's in Texas, he's been moved around to all sorts of prisons. Even now, he's not allowed access to the press. We are not allowed to talk to him or interview him. The Department of Justice won't allow it. Now, that is what's really disturbing to me, because at what point, I mean, we're not talking
about... This is
about
like the stuff that Alexander Solzhenitsyn experienced.
Right, you're not talking, first of all, he was convicted of something that I can't, just in my own investigation, find to be something that he did. He was falsely accused, falsely trialed, and falsely convicted. But, you know, let us assume for a minute that he did do whatever it is, which is basically a white-collar crime. It is a nonviolent crime. Why is the press not allowed to have access to him?
Right, well, obviously because he's the man who knew too much. You can read all about it over at RawStory.com. Get this story, Larissa Alexandrovna, get this story and share it with everybody you know, the story of Don Siegelman. Larissa, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And happy birthday.
Thank you.
Have a great day. 16 minutes past the hour.
Exposing the con in conservative, this is the Tom Hartman Program.
Anything goes. I won't ilu chu sha ko ja she na chu shu shu sha le pong I ni da le da. Anything goes.
Hey, welcome back. Anything Goes Friday, 21 minutes past the hour. Boy, this mind-boggling story. You will recall when the NIE was first released a couple of days ago, saying the National Intelligence Estimate, saying that there was apparently having been written a year ago before the 2006 elections and has been sat on for a year, that when this thing was first released, my comment about it was because it is so destructive to the Cheney, Bush, neocon, Bolton and company attempts to have us have a war with Iran for the political purposes, frankly, in my opinion, of the Republicans, and for the financial purposes of the industrial, the military-industrial complex, and even the media, you know, would love to have a war. I mean, it drives up eyeballs going to TV sets and drives up advertising revenue. Everybody makes money on a war, except for the nation as a whole. I mean, you know, wars hollow out countries, but all the fat cats get a whole lot fatter. And so why would there be this NIE coming out saying, hey, there's no reason to have this war? And when this thing came out, I said, I'll bet that somebody inside the CIA is saying, George, we are going to push back. We are not going to let you lie to the American people anymore. And now it's coming out. This over at the blog of this is Sic Semper Tyrannis 2007, and this is the blog of retired Colonel W. Patrick Lang, a former official in the Defense Intelligence Agency, and you can find a link to it, and you can find a summary of it over at thinkprogress.org. He says, senior CIA analysts pushed for NIE's key judgments on Iran to be released, threatening to speak to the media if they weren't. Here's what he writes. The Jungle Telegraph in Washington is booming with news of the Iran NIE. I am told that the reason the conclusions of the NIE were released is that it was communicated to the White House that, quote, intelligence career seniors were lined up to go to jail if necessary if the documents just were not given to the public. Translation? Someone in that group would have gone to the media on the record to disclose its contents. Just as I guessed. I mean, these guys are so, up to this point, they have been so in control of message. They lied us into the war in Iraq, and the intelligence agencies kept their mouths shut. Good professionals, you know, they legally can't go public, and so they didn't. And the same thing in the military. Now we've got the military pushing back, and we've got the intelligence agencies pushing back. So the only question now is, how much power do Bush and Cheney still have? And the Republican buddies and those in the media and those in the military-industrial complex who would like to see a war with Iran, how much power do they still have? And frankly, I think this is an incredibly unstable time for us. Because if there is a power struggle going on, and it certainly looks like there is, then Bush and Cheney may pull power by simply declaring the war. And then you got Joe Biden saying if Bush actually goes to war without an authorization from Congress, the first thing he'll do is step onto the floor of the Senate and call for a resolution to impeach the president. Now, he'd have to have somebody in the House actually do that. Impeachment must originate in the House. But nonetheless, when a senator stands up and says it's time to impeach the president, everybody in the House says, oh, yeah? That's interesting. Maybe we should talk about this. I mean, it would completely change the dialogue. So the question, and I don't have the answer to this. The question that we all have to be watching for, and I suspect that we're gonna discover the answer to it in the nuance that you see and hear and get at coming out of the media. The nuance of, I thought it was interesting. For example, several of the cable shows yesterday, they'd have on people like Pat Buchanan and on the Reich, and then Frank Gaffney on the far Reich as guests. Oh, yeah, let's have a right-winger and an uber-right-winger. Say what? This is balanced? What that says to me is that corporate media would really like to have a war. And, in fact, CNN has canceled now their plans for a special on the war in Iran. They were putting this thing together. I mean, they were all set to make a pile of money on this thing, and they had to cancel it because of the NIE. So it's just you know, the old Chinese curse, we live in interesting times. We sure do. This now is the question. Bush, we know from the Downing Street minutes, the Bush administration was prepared to and did, in fact, fix the intelligence to meet the policy. That is, the policy was invade Iraq. The intelligence didn't agree with that. The military didn't agree with it. They fixed the intelligence. Obviously, they're trying to do the same thing with Iran. And the intelligence agencies said, sorry, fool me once, shame on you. Fool me twice, shame on me. We ain't going to let this happen. And they're pushing back. And you've got senior intelligence officials willing to go to prison, willing to commit what arguably would be treason, violating the state secrets of the United States in order to prevent these guys from lying us into another war. So who in the end, at the end of the day, who is going to have more power? Is it going to be the White House, or is it going to be the agencies within the White House? 27 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Listener supported talk radio, supported by you, our listeners, supporting our sponsors. Listen in particular for local sponsors in your area that you might think, hey, good product. Let them know that you're listening. And, of course, our national sponsors as well. Thanks so much for listening. 34 minutes past the hour, 866-303-2270, our telephone number. And Michael in Los Angeles. Hey, Michael, what's up?
Hey, how are you?
Just great. What's up?
Can you hear me?
I can.
Oh, I was... Hello?
Yeah, can you hear me?
Just on the Romney's remarks yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like to hear the Democrats come out with something that says the Constitution's a legal document, not religious. Whenever you mix religion with government, the historical record has always been disaster. The Founding Fathers knew this from world history, their own history, even their own faith. Render to Caesar what is Caesar's, God to God. And finally, the Bill of Rights gives, you know, the right to remain silent is not the jurisdiction of torturers, terrorists, tyrants, or religious freaks. It's a symbol, a guarantee of freedom, of free people, of a free world. The Bill of Rights, particularly the right to remain silent, has got to be protected.
Yeah, absolutely. Well said, Michael. Thank you very much. And this is interesting. Over at Talking Points memo today, the headline, this is by Eric Kleefeld, the headline, Romney spokesman won't say if atheists have a place in America. They've asked a spokesperson for the, keep in mind, Mitt Romney said in his speech, he said, it is as if they're intent on establishing a new religion in America, the religion of secularism. They're wrong. Well, I'm sorry, Mitt, this is a secular country. This is not a theocracy. It is a government of laws, not a government of gods. Not a government of priests. It's not a government of Protestants or Catholics or Mormons or Jews or Hindus or Buddhists or deists or Unitarian. It is a government of laws. And to have a man who is running for president of the United States suggest that agnostics and atheists, who are part of us too, have no role to play in government is frankly horrifying. I don't have another word than horror. He said it is as if they're intent on establishing a new religion in America, the religion of secularism, and they're wrong. I mean, I've made the argument that some people who are atheists, you know, pursue it as if it's a religion. You know, they're evangelical about it. They have a belief system around it. But they're not trying to take over our government. Our government is not our Constitution is not a religious document. It doesn't mention God even once. In fact, it specifically says there shall be no religious test for public office. Anyhow, enough of the rant. We'll go back to your phone calls here. Jeff in Portland. Hey, Jeff.
Good morning, Tom.
Hi. Good morning.
Hello?
Yes. I think people are having a hard time hearing me today.
I was calling about the Republicans refusing to allow
anything to go forward in the Senate. And I understand that Harry Reid's a nice guy and he's really poor and he's really soft, but it would be really nice.
Harry Reid is an ex-Marine. You know, I don't get why everybody thinks Harry Reid is well, I do get it why everybody thinks Harry Reid is a wimp. He's behaving like one relative to the Republicans. But, you know, Harry, find your Marineness.
Right. And if he was to take and put all the new spending bills at the back of the list, keep the Senate in session until they go through the list on an up and down vote on every single bill before he got to a spending bill, like for the war, and force the Republican president that's in there now to veto, then the people in the country would see where the obstruction
yeah,
is.
Yeah, I agree. And if he forced the Republicans to actually filibuster, to say, you know, okay, you guys want to have a filibuster, that's fine. You're going to stand right here all night and talk. And that's the way it's going to be. If we've had 57 filibusters, I'll bet 99% of Americans don't know that. They would know that if Harry Reid had turned it into theater. And I believe that he should. You know, I think that it's vital that he do. Jeff, thanks a lot for the call. Richard in North Bergen, New Jersey. Hey, Richard.
Hello.
You're on the air.
Okay, hold it. I called up for two reasons. One is you asked about before. Florida and Nevada are also early, and they don't have permission, I guess.
Right.
No, Nevada, yeah, Florida and Nevada don't. North Carolina and, Michigan doesn't and Florida doesn't. Nevada and North and South Carolina do have permission to go early.
Right.
The date is...
And so Michigan and Florida's delegates are not going to be seated
also,
at the...
How we can get at those people who have lied in front of Congress?
Yeah.
Is a it's illegal under federal code, Title 18, Part 1, Chapter 47, Section 1. It has to do with crimes and criminal procedures, statements. And basically, if you lie in front of Congress or a subcommittee or a committee, even if you're not under oath, it's a felony.
Yeah. Yeah, no, you're absolutely right, and there are so many of these guys who have done so much of this. We really need to get them in front of, if nothing else, get them in front of Henry Waxman. Obsidian in Raleigh, North Carolina. Hey, Obsidian.
Hello to you and yours, Tom.
Thank you.
I'm not sure if you're going to view this as taking you to task or whatnot, but regarding the aspect of voting and all that, I have no problem with voting to get people into office that need to be doing what should be done for the people. But when you have corporate complexes that basically provide these voting machines that the people are doing their voting on, and then you turn around, if it doesn't go the way they think they should for their particular politician, that they're basically kissing tail, as it were, and then they turn around and flip the vote where it goes in the favor of that politician, and not to way of the people.
Obsidian,
so,
you're singing my song.
This.
I mean,
why even bother when it's being bought off?
Yeah, no, you're singing my song. Back 4 years ago, 5 years ago, actually, it's probably 6 years ago now. I wrote one of the first articles on voting machines. Bev Harris was about the only person out there who was talking about this stuff, and she was doing a great job. And I wrote an article called "The Theft of Your Vote Is Just an Electron Away," or words to that effect. I forget the exact title of it. MoveOn.org actually commissioned me to write a roundup piece on electronic voting machines. Alternate ran it. They mailed it out to, at that time, they had 1.3 million people on their mailing list. They'll tell you how long ago that was. And was one of the first people to actually be taught. And my position on this goes beyond just, oh my God, the voting machines and they're insecure. The real crime against our republic is that we have privatized of all the things in government that should not be privatized, the beating heart of democracy itself, our vote. I can understand where they might say, okay, the concession at Yellowstone is going to be turned over to Marriott. We're going to let them run the concession for us. You know, we're going to privatize the concession because it'll make more profit for the government. Okay, I don't think it should be that way. I think government facilities should be government facilities. But, you know, I would go along with that. But when they say, no, we're going to privatize the vote, say what? That is the last thing that should be in the hands of private for-profit corporations who are only answerable to the profit motive and to their CEOs, and arguably are not even answerable to their stockholders, just to their board of directors. It is the last thing.
Well, apparently I did not take it to task, so what can I tell you?
Yeah, well, you know, it's absolutely wrong. And Obsidian, thank you for calling and pointing it out and giving me an opportunity to rant about it once more. It's something that I've been ranting about so much and for so long that, you know, sometimes I'll let a few days or weeks go by without getting back to it, and I shouldn't. I should be on it every day. Jim in Seattle. Hey, Jim, what's up?
Yeah, hi, Tom. Can you hear me?
I can. Are you having a hard time hearing me, Jim?
I am right now, actually, but I would like to get back to something Bernie Sanders said earlier, if you can hear me.
Yes, I can. It's apparently we've got a problem in New York with the audio going out to our callers, and people are having a hard time hearing me, but we can hear you fine.
Okay, anyway, just if you recall, Mr. Sanders said that there were 4 billion, letters, credit card applications, you know, the 0% credit card applications sent out. And what I and some friends have been doing for many years, and I'd like to put this out there, is that every time, and this will put a smile on your face, I think, every time I get one of those, I set it aside, and then, I don't know, once a week or so, I go ahead and I open them all up, and I take out the return envelope card, I cut everything into 3 pieces, I put them all back into the envelope, and when I get a stack of 8 or 10 of them or so, whatever, I go to the post office and send them back, but in each envelope, I say, please take me off your list. But so if everyone did that, and we had, you know, 4 billion people returning their trash back to them in the envelope that they pay for and the pay for the postage, maybe we would get their attention and maybe something could be done.
Yeah, it's an old way to fight back against direct mail junk mail that I salute you for. It's absolutely. Sean in Santa Rosa, California. Hey, Sean, got about a half a minute here. What's up?
Okay, I have the same problem out here in Santa Rosa, not just New York. I can't hear you that well.
Yeah, I'm sorry, Sean. The engineers are working on it.
No problem. You know, yesterday you said something that kind of gets me every time I think it comes up, is that that the congressmen don't want, are reluctant, or senators are reluctant to pull the funds to stop the war because of the backlash politically. Like, you know, they've got to
right.
go, you know, their fear of they won't get
yeah, they'll be accused of not supporting the troops.
They pull the funding. And I sure, every time I hear that, I'm like, if that's the only way it seems to me to pull the, to stop the war, then I'm all for it. And I would support every senator and whoever I could vote for that would do that.
Yeah. And Sean, I think that you're not alone in that. I suspect that most Americans feel exactly the same way. And that is, in fact, how the Vietnam War was ended. Congress cut off the funding. And Gerry Ford had to say, okay, that's it. We're pulling the troops out. And, you know, that's how it works, and that's what Congress is going to have to do again. It's 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, the No Boring Zone. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
The trees are green, red roses too. I see them bloom for me and you. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world. I see skies of blue.
Thanks so much to my producer, David Poole, to Louise Hartman, to Chris Rosen, and Lauren Kirshner, and Marcus Hellman at Air America, to Sue Nethercutt, the folks in our chat room, and Mike Toth, who does our audio archives on our website, to our affiliates, our sponsors, and to you for listening to our program. It is much appreciated. 866-303-2270, our telephone number. And let's see here. Mary in Los Angeles, California. Hey, Mary, welcome to the program. And can you hear me?
Just barely.
Just barely, okay.
I'm calling regarding a caller from, I don't know, probably about an hour ago or so, named Chris, who had this question about, you know, why should I pay in a we society, why should I pay for people for their medical care? And basically what I wanted to say to Chris and to others who might hold that view is that my vision of the we society, we wouldn't necessarily need to pay for those people because we'd be able to provide things like mental health care to prevent people from getting so depressed that they turn to substance abuse problems. We'd be able to pay for, you know, different agricultural programs perhaps that would help provide nutritious food so that people weren't, you know, grabbing fast food on the way to their second job every day.
So that kids aren't eating fast food as their primary food, but instead families actually have time to have meals together.
Right, because some of these problems, you know, a lot of them are about personal responsibility, but some of them are also,
going to be covered, I think, in that spirit of togetherness and that spirit of community, you know, I think we'll be able to pick up some of those people who kind of fall along the wayside because we'll be able to put into place the kind of programs that would be really beneficial to the entire society, including those folks.
Amen. Mary, you said it brilliantly, and I thank you so much for calling and saying it. Malcolm in Portland, Oregon. Hey, Malcolm.
Hey, I had something else I was going to talk about, but you brought up the Mitt Romney thing, so
yeah.
I've decided I think that's more important. You know, I hope that, you know, people are aware and are listening to, you know, what he says in different venues, and that they, you know, have some knowledge or becomes aware to them the knowledge of the Mormon Church that to express openly that you do not support a theocratic state in America is cause for excommunication from the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints.
No, I don't believe that, Malcolm.
You don't believe that?
No, I don't believe that the Mormon Church. I mean, you'll have to prove it to me. I would be astounded if any mainstream religion, and I realize Mormons are, you know, between 1 and 2% of Americans. It's a relatively small percentage, but it's still not, you know, just some local church that the guy down the street started last week. Any organized religion that size in the United States was calling for theocracy in this country. I would be astounded. But Mitt Romney seems to be calling for theocracy in the United States, and that does concern me. And whether he's a Mormon or not, I don't care if he's a Mormon or if he's a Catholic or a Baptist or whatever. It doesn't matter.
And, of course, neither do I. So if you just give me 1 second here, I know how you get kind of going on these things, especially when it's religion. But what I'll do, because you said, you know, I'll have to prove it to you, there are lots of different books I could refer you to, but one that has a great number of resources in it where you could look at other in its reference section is One Nation Under God by Richard Abane.
Okay.
And the book
can you quote me one statement by the senior management, as it were, the you know, I don't know the Mormon Church well enough to, you know, the Church of Latter-day Saints well enough to even know what they call the head guy, but you know, they're equivalent to the Pope. They do have a head guy, I know.
The
head prophet, yeah. A statement by him calling for theocracy in the United States, I don't know of any. And I'd be I just have to assume if it had ever happened that it would be common knowledge. Although, you know, there's a lot of things, you know, it's like you would have thought that everybody in the country would know that Don Siegelman was a political prisoner. So, you know, there's probably a lot of things we don't all know. But Malcolm, thanks for the call. We'll see how this shakes out. I'm sure that there will be more calls on the topic as time goes on. Jerry in the Bronx. Hey, Jerry.
Hello?
You're on the air. Can you hear me, Jerry?
Only very slightly, but I was calling about, you referred before to Mitt Romney, and you said that what he said threatened the Article 6 of the Constitution, which forbade a religious test for public office. But the reason this is becoming more acceptable is because the press is now accepting the idea of religion as an issue in the campaign. In the last Republican debate, the candidates were asked what they believed about the Bible. Somebody should have said then, this is a violation of Article 6.
Right.
Which says there should be no religious
test. Well, but see, the Article 6 doesn't say that the media shall not have a religious test. The media is perfectly welcome to have a media a religious test. What we have to do as both citizens and as consumers of media is push back at the media and say, you asked what? Are you kidding me? Why are you asking candidates for president of the United States questions about their religion? This is not, we're not running somebody for head prophet of the Church of Latter-day Saints or pope or, you know, head of the Baptist convention or something. We're talking about the secular office of president of the United States. That should be the question that we are asking of our media. That should be the pushback. So anyhow. Coming up Monday on the Tom Hartman program here, Dan Gaynor and I will be debating whether or not we're already in a recession. It's International Human Rights Day. Ajamu Baraka is here on examples of persistent racism in the U.S. and what to do about it, plus the best of the rest of the news right here on the Tom Hartman program, your radio support group for We the People. And don't forget, my friends, activism begins with you. Democracy begins with you. Tag, you're it. Have a great weekend.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.